Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, 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 welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski, along with my co-host, the greatest endocrinologist to walk the planet, Dr. Kyle Nadolski Jr. With us today, we got a returning guest, Dr. Lauren Colenso-Semple, along with a new guest, Dr. Stacy Sims, both of whom are exercise physiologists. Today, we're having a friendly debate discussion all about women's training and nutrition and that type of thing. Since my brother and I are not women, we're staying out of the debate, and we're going to try to say just moderators. So welcome to the podcast, y'all.
Thanks.
All right.
Thanks for having us.
Now, my brother's going to be doing a lot of the questions and whatever. I'll just kind of be sitting here hanging out and try to moderate a little bit, but go ahead and talk about the format.
All right. So basically, yeah, we'll keep it relatively simple. What we don't want is this to turn into some bizarre presidential debate like our politics in the United States have become. And so we're not going to hold you to 2 minutes and then a rebuttal and all this stuff. We'll try to make it conversational, but we do want to ask, generally speaking, I'm going to start with Stacy, because this is where some of these topics have come up with a little bit of your, I guess, you know, we should talk about a little bit of the background, the famous quote. What's your famous quote? Your basic stance.
Women aren't tiny men, right?
That's yeah. True. I wanted her to say it. Thanks, Spencer.
Okay. Cool.
Women are not small men.
All right. And so then this is, you know, I think there have been some things out there that have, you know, triggered conversations, you know, and we want to talk about some of the evidence behind it and maybe some of the clinical practicality. So in the medical world, you know, Spencer does family medicine, obesity, cardiometabolic medicine. I do endocrinology, a lot of diabetes, a lot of menopausal hormone therapy and stuff. And so we also like to come back to what's pragmatic, not only evidence-based, but what is clinically reasonable, pragmatic, and stuff like that. And so what we'd like to do, I think, you guys tell me, we can modify this, is I'd like to start with getting Stacy's views on some of these questions that we already put out there, have you talk about it, some of the evidence behind it, how you came to some of those views, and then, you know, for a couple of minutes each, and then we'll have Lauren talk about, you know, from her perspective, again, with evidence, and, you know, we can talk about and cite studies if necessary, we can link them in the podcast, and then, you know, just kind of discuss clinically pragmatic recommendations for people out there and if anything would change or not based upon the discussion. What does anybody think of that?
Yeah, no, that's fine. Yeah, sounds good.
Very good. So, right. Yeah, some of the background is, you know, with social media, we do response videos and it's sometimes some of the context can, you know.
That's absolutely it. So it's the context that gets lost. Yeah.
Yeah, good to have a discussion. We'll see where this goes.
All right. Good deal. Okay. So I would like for our audiences out there, let's start. Stacy, can you give yourself an introduction and a little bit of your background that got to where you are? And then we'll do that with Lauren too. A little bit more detail than what Spencer gave.
Oh, yeah. So I'm an environmental exercise physiologist and nutrition scientist, and I have been looking at sex differences for over 20 years or so. First got into it when I was 17 and my dad asked what I wanted to do with my life facing university. And I said I wanted to be an Army Ranger or a SEAL. And he said I couldn't because I was a girl. And at that time, you couldn't because you were a girl. It was the first time anything like that had ever been presented to me. So then when I went to university and was seeing all the stuff that was presented with regards to ex-phys and metabolism, the representation was just men or they, and that didn't sit well. So as I started really pushing and trying to look and say, you know what, as a woman and an athlete, these things don't hold. So early days, really trying to get into understanding why certain training protocols didn't work, why there was no representation of women in any of the literature. And so that's been my mission the whole way through. So I've been an athlete and academic for 25 some odd years, where as an athlete, wanting questions answered, going to the lab or looking for the answers. Also working in public health and epidemiology and seeing the crossovers there and what can't cross over. So it's been an interesting ride for sure. And seeing how things have changed over the past about 5 or 6 years has been encouraging with the way that women's health research is going.
Cool. All right, Lauren.
Yeah, I come from a kind of practical background. I worked as a fitness professional, but my interest in science has gone from the more translational work, so looking at muscle growth, strength gains, et cetera, to more of the molecular work. And I came from a place of seeing that gap in the literature, you know, about 11, 12 years ago. And I'm enthusiastic to see more and more studies in women. One of the primary reasons that I find a lot of researchers were hesitant to study women was because of concerns about menstrual cycle or hormonal contraceptives. And so some of the work that I've done has been to try to determine, you know, if and when those are relevant. And if not, can we kind of decrease that barrier to make more labs able to do research in women or feel like they are empowered to do so.
Okay, very cool. Good deal. All right. Well, let's just get started. So one of the first topics we want to talk about is fasted training. So one, we have to talk about what that even is. I think somebody on our socials today was like, can somebody even say what the heck that even means, sort of thing? There have been a lot of studies over recent years looking into nutritional interventions for obesity, but also just for weight loss, body composition, different types of fasting strategies, intermittent fasting, time-restricted feeding. And then historically, there have been debates and studies on, oh, does fasting exercise improve fat loss just because of the way our body uses fuel and fasting versus fed states, and then some of those questions. So, Stacy, does fasting trigger stress responses, impair performance, mood, metabolic health in women differently than men? And, you know, and what are some of the data behind it, and what are your practical suggestions that are out there?
Yeah. So when we're looking at some of the baseline, and this will appeal to you being an endocrinologist, when we look at some of the baseline aspects of what happens under stress and exercise, first and foremost, we know that women have a higher resting acetylated ghrelin and also have a decrease in the way that insulin has a response. And part of that is because women's bodies have a protective mechanism to try to maintain an energy homeostasis. So when we're looking at what's happening with fasted exercise, first, when women are in a fasted state, they have an elevation of cortisol. And we know that ghrelin and cortisol kind of have an interchange where you have an elevation in cortisol, you also have an elevation in ghrelin. And we also have to bring estradiol into the account too, because when we're looking at how ghrelin, especially acetylated, which is the active form, affects things like neuropeptide Y, which also leads into kisspeptin. So we see that neuropeptide Y, which is one that increases appetite with ghrelin, which Casey, you would know about as being an endocrinologist, right? We also have estradiol that comes and decreases, so they kind of counter each other. So when we start looking at fasted exercise for women, we see that there is a blunting in fat oxidation. We also see that there is a decrease in the way that the body actually uses fat at rest. And we see an increase in this ghrelin and the stimulation of appetite. And this holds through. So when we look at someone who's doing fasted exercise, later as we're seeing the shift in cortisol peak, we see a shift in circadian rhythm, we see a shift in our luteinizing hormone pulse, we see a shift in our estradiol pulses. So it changes the way the appetite proceeds throughout the day. So when we're looking at the data for women, we see that if they are doing fasted exercise, they have a blunting in fat oxidation during exercise, an increase in their appetite stimulation for simple carbohydrate, and they tend to move less throughout the day. When we look at the reverse, when we look at fed exercise, which is not a lot, it's just bringing some food in so that blood sugar levels come up, which then decreases your acetylgalin. It decreases your cortisol, allows women to hit intensities, and increases fat oxidation. But in men, it doesn't work the same because they don't have the same responses of conservation that women do. So when I'm talking about it on a popular podcast, it's really hard to get into the weeds of what are these hormones and how they interact. So you have to jump right to, well, if we are doing fasted exercise, it affects the hypothalamus and the conservation. And this is where we get a lot of the nuances that get missed in these conversations.
Okay. So, yeah, I think, you know, we can, yeah, we can get into the cortisol and stuff because, you know, as we know, it's certainly normal for the cortisol to peak in the morning. It's certainly normal for cortisol to go up with exercise and stuff like that. So, you know, we can get into those details from my perspective at some other time. But Lauren, can you respond to that with the data-driven, you know, practicality of what's actually been shown in studies looking at these different nuances in females specifically with fasted training in different different variables like that?
Well, if we look at the outcome of interest, which I feel like is a bit missing from the response, because I'm not entirely sure if you're saying that, you know, this is problematic for hormonal health, or if you're going to increase body fat because of your speculations about appetite dysregulation. But in either case, I think it's really important to look at the human trials and are they measuring that outcome of interest? So then we would say, well, during, you know, 8, 12, 16 weeks of fasted state training, these individuals developed some sort of menstrual cycle dysfunction, or after that time period of fasted state training, they actually gained more body fat, or their body fat loss was attenuated. And we don't have that data. In fact, you know, when we look at fed versus fasted state training in those human clinical trials in women, we see pretty similar changes in body composition, provided you have sufficient protein and calories throughout the day.
And this is a nuance, because if we're looking just at sports science, we see that there's a very small N when we're looking at this. When we're looking at chronobiology and phase shifting, which is the bigger question here, like what are we doing here when we're doing fasted exercise? There are a significant amount of human trials that show this phase shifting alters cortisol responses. And when we see what's happening with cortisol responses and the peak changes, this is what we're seeing leads to metabolic dysfunction, even in people who are exercising. It's not about body fat gain. It's not about hormonal health. It's about overall longevity and health span. What's happening when we're doing fasted exercise in women? So we see Hagebane has a lot of data on that. There's quite a few people in the public health research that are doing that, and I'm happy to send you the links to read about it. It's the bigger picture. It's not just about, is it body comp change? We can look at calorie restriction versus fasting. I think that was one of the questions as well. If we're looking at calorie restriction, yeah, we see the same kind of effects with fasting and calorie restriction. It's just people find it easier to fast because we've been wrapped in this sociocultural thing where women aren't supposed to be eating. So it's okay to hold that fast. But we see the long-term outcomes on metabolic health. It's just not appropriate for women in overall metabolic health to be doing fasted exercise.
Are there some long-term trials that you're referring to?
Put out because specifically,
because we've seen like a lot of meta-analyses and stuff that kind of show no real difference.
I'm not a fan of meta-analyses because it loses the nuances. So yeah, I'm happy. I have a whole list of tabs here that I can definitely send you, and you can have a long, deep read into some of the outcomes that we're talking about from a metabolic health standpoint.
Any specific type of outcome, like anyone, is it longevity? Is it blood sugar regulation? Anything?
Yeah. So if we're looking at fasted exercise and the effect on, let's just say, glucose homeostasis, right? We see that women end up with poor blood glucose control, especially if they're holding their fast till noon or after. So this means that they have a reduction in insulin sensitivity. They have a higher amount, as I was saying, the acetylgalin. It has an interplay with the way that their luteinizing hormone and appetite hormones actually pulse because everything gets phase shifted. So we're starting to see a lot of that I guess, insulin resistance in older women who are exercising and trying to lose body fat. So in the perimenopausal space, there's that offshoot of insulin resistance coming with the interplay of estradiol, but also when you're adding fasting onto that, we're seeing a decrease in the body's ability for glucose homeostasis.
So you're saying fasted training in women compared to men will worsen insulin sensitivity over the long run. That's the claim.
Okay. But are there any, so I guess from an, again, from an endocrinologist perspective, you know, we look at, you know, we have, biomarkers, you know, that are, not actually outcomes per se, but, you know, the studies really looking at all these different types of exercise and metabolic outcomes essentially show exercise at any time of the day is better than nothing for glucose control, long-term insulin resistance, type 2 diabetes risk, and complications of type 2 diabetes. But so do you have any citations to say, yes, somehow that was better than no exercise or better than maybe better than fed exercise? But even that's
the claim. That's the claim. It's fed versus fasting.
So for like type 2 diabetes outcomes per se, because I know there's studies that show that's not the case, but
I think she's saying, well, let's let Dr. Sim say, is it in perimenopausal, otherwise healthy women, fasted training would lead to worsened insulin sensitivity compared to fed training? I just want to make sure it's a very clear claim.
Yes. Okay. And when we start looking at the active women population, that's different from the obese population. Because when we're seeing people who are sedentary, they're obese, they might exercise with regards to like walking, low intensity, just moving. That's a completely different population than the active women's at, right? So when we're looking at women who are already active and already have epigenetic changes within the muscle to be able to use GLUT4 in a better capacity, they have more muscle to be a glucose sink. When they are doing fasted exercise, we see that that doesn't really come into play. When we're looking at the increase in the dysregulation of cortisol, we're seeing a increase in insulin resistance. And it does have a play back into how the body is responding to fasted exercise with regards to what is it trying to do when it's exercising, what intensities, what is the follow on with our appetite hormones and the way that insulin has a play with this, I guess, inverse relationship with ghrelin and cortisol. Does that make sense?
It sounds like you're kind of talking about these acute shifts and then speculating about what that could mean in terms of long-term outcomes, because otherwise you'd be saying there are long-term studies where people were doing fasted state training for a long enough period of time that they actually developed these, you know, pathologies. Is that correct?
I can say that, and I can forward you those. I'm trying to explain the mechanisms of why we're seeing this, because if you have an acute bout of exercise, have an acute change, that's not going to be a long-term change, right? But if you have a repetitive action of these acute changes, it's going to lead to long-term outcome.
Yes and no. It depends on the acute measure of interest, right? So if that's one of the reasons why people originally were really excited about fasted cardio, because it said, oh, you know, look, we're improving fat oxidation, and therefore could that transfer into long-term fat loss? Turns out it doesn't. So we have to be really careful about speculating on long-term outcomes based on those acute measures.
Correct. And I'm not speculating.
Okay. Just to confirm, are you saying that fasted exercise would actually worsen compared to not exercise, or just worsen it compared to, or not worsen, just be less effective compared to fed? I just want to make sure.
We're talking about fed versus fasted.
Okay. And so, and it'll just not do as well as you're saying compared to fed.
Correct.
But not worsen insulin sensitivity, or does it worsen?
Compared to sedentary, that's not in the question. It's between fed and fasted. So if we're doing fed exercise, there isn't as great a change in insulin resistance as there is in fasted exercise.
Okay, but again, that's the, like Lauren is saying, that's you're really kind of honing in on the short-term effects, kind of like the cortisol stuff. So we know that, you know, increasing your cortisol in the morning, I mean, it's normal to have a cortisol response in the morning. It's normal to have cortisol go up with exercise. It's actually normal and not necessarily great for cortisol to be up chronically in, like, say, anorexia when people are too thin. You know, you talk about getting into low body fat and kisspeptin and all that stuff. It all kind of works together. But that those acute changes per se don't lead to long-term, you know, insulin resistance and progression to type 2 diabetes if it's because of exercise specifically. But you're very much just saying, like you said, fed state exercise in the morning versus fasted exercise. I'm saying morning, I guess it doesn't really matter. But Lauren, do you have any response with you know, some of the longer term studies that we have? I mean, like you said, I mentioned the meta-analyses pretty much kind of show at.
Yeah, well, I think we need to look at studies where they're actually measuring those outcomes. And so, I mean, I'm very surprised to hear there would be large-scale clinical trials measuring people training fasted long-term, and they're actually developing some sort of health issue from that. I'd love if you would share those, because frankly, I don't think that's out there. What we have is this narrative or hypothesis that's quite interesting based on some short-term measures, based on speculation that chronically these short-term measures could influence longevity, you know, quote unquote, right? But that's really what I'm hearing. If we did have data indicating that, you know, training in a fasted state could somehow be harmful, then we would be having an entirely different conversation. But, you know, when I hear kisspeptin and nutrient sensitivity and ghrelin and cortisol, then those aren't really assessing long-term outcomes. Did you lose muscle mass? Did you gain fat mass? Did you actually develop diabetes?
Yeah, and then I also want to point out that Spencer was asking me for one example, and we've gone down the rabbit hole of insulin, right? Because I use that as the one example. So we look at long-term outcomes. Yes, we see that there is a change in body comp. We see that there is a change in metabolic profile, for more so for women than in men. Is there a long-term, massive, randomized controlled trial? No, because we haven't done that yet. We're looking at smaller studies of 20 to 50 people. And that's the problem with women's health. So we're looking at that. We're looking at the endocrinology research, and we're trying to pull it in. So is it speculation? There's a little bit, but that's what we do with science, right? We look at the data that's available, and we bring it into the best practice. So if I'm working with a woman who's having significant issues of changing body comp, she is having issues with metabolic syndrome, and she's already active and has been active her whole life, and she's doing fasted training, we have her do fed training, we see different outcomes. So when we're looking at what is the big speculation, you're starting to pull into, I need a massive randomized control trial. We know that those don't exist.
Well, you told me that they did, because I pointed to the studies that we do have.
I said I have studies that I can pass you, but I didn't say that it was a massive randomized control trial.
Well, we have studies in women looking at, you know, 3 months of fasted versus fed state training, and there aren't differences in those outcomes. So okay. I hear you if you're saying I'm working with this one individual and they were having an issue, and so then we made a change. But that's different from an evidence-based conversation of making the claim that, you know, women should never train fasted for fear that this and that will happen.
I'm not saying for fear. I'm also saying we have this evidence, and then how do we add it practically? So this is where I'm saying, look, we have this evidence, and I am working specifically with individuals as well. So we use anecdotal and we use the evidence. I'd like to see your studies as well. And we can have a complete exchange and put them in the podcast notes. Happy to do that.
We shall do that.
Okay. So, yeah. So just to recap, Dr. Lauren saying there's evidence there's not really a difference. Dr. Stacy saying there's evidence there is a difference. And we're in multiple outcomes, body fat, glycemic changes, all that type of thing.
Yeah. And what we're saying is we need our patients to do some exercise.
Oh, yeah. That's the question.
Exercise is good across the board. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Hey, Dr. Okay. Stacy, like, here's just a question. Like, what if a patient comes in, and I'm sorry to disrupt this a little bit, but I'm kind of curious, like, if somebody comes in and the only way they're ever going to exercise is in a fasted state for whatever reason, would you have them not exercise or exercise? That's just
movement. Definitely movement. Okay. Like, the body is designed to move, right? Yeah, yes, there's optimal, optimal and there's reality, yeah. Right? There's optimal when we see, and then there's the reality of the human touch, okay. Right?
Yeah, all right.
And I'm not saying these are the hard and fast rules, which I've been accused of saying. I'm saying this is what we see, and you have to make it work for you. If you can only do fasted training, okay, but know that there are some potential ramifications down the line that we see in the evidence. Is it going to work and it's going to affect you directly? There's a lot of things that are nuanced within that. And I think part of the conversation in all of the science, especially social media, is you have the bell curve, right? And we look at the signs of the bell curve, but there are outliers. And people are always like, well, I want to be specific to me, but they might be in the outlier or they might be in the bell curve. They might be early adopter. They might be an early adopter with some extra nuance, or they might be someone over here who's just starting to toe the line and go, yeah, I'm going to come in. But when you bring it all together on social media and you have clickbait and you have different nuances that are missed, it becomes a big conversation that doesn't get had. So that's why I'm glad we're having this conversation to be able to pull the nuances out.
And that's fair. So as we know, on an individual basis, we talk to patients about, well, here's what the evidence says, but you are a person. We're going to individualize it. We're going to figure out for you. And that's what we all need to be doing. So that's a fair thing. All right. Well, we just hammered that out for a while. And so we'll put some data and citations into the show notes. All right. So now perhaps that will lead us into the next question. I guess I'm going to throw in there is the post-workout protein timing in men versus women. So I think, you know, once upon a time, we thought that, oh, we all have to get in our protein within our training window. And then it kind of turned out that it was more about, that peri-workout sort of thing, about the total amount of protein optimization within the full day. But I do remember some of the researchers saying, well, but with the caveat that if you do fasted training, you may want to get it in like more immediate. So I kind of stuck that in my own little mind for most people. But Stacy, what are your recommendations for post-workout protein timing? And again, in men versus women, the data behind it, and then we'll go to Lauren.
Yeah, I think Luke Van Loon's group brought out the 100-gram protein study a few months ago, where you had a bolus of 100 grams in a bunch of men, and they saw muscle protein synthesis going up over the course of 24 hours. And so, you know, that there's no absolute there. Caveat was it wasn't done in women. When we start looking at some of the studies that are done in resistance trained women, we see that 30 grams is an optimal amount within 2 hours, right? So we're seeing just on protein synthesis. We're looking at baseline or return to baseline with glucose. In women, we see it's up to 90 minutes. So there's a shorter window. For men, it's 3+ hours depending on intensity. But again, because women's bodies are so good at trying to remove an energy deficit, it comes back down to baseline quickly. How does that affect protein and mTOR? We know that in things like the follicular phase, up to 2 hours, we start seeing, you know, we see an uptick in mTOR. 0 to 4 hours, it starts to die off. They haven't done it in luteal phase, so I don't know what those are either. When we look at the outcomes from low energy availability, especially when we're looking at within-day energy deficit, we see that women who withhold calories post-exercise end up with more menstrual cycle dysfunction. And it has to do with, again, the increase of the catabolism that occurs after exercise, and you want to shut it down. So when we start talking about protein timing, it's more about nutrient timing. It's not the absolute macronutrient of what are we trying to do? We need to get protein in. When I talk about post-exercise nutrition, it's
looking at every eating opportunity to reduce that catabolic state. Because when women are going and putting the time in to do exercise, they want to see an outcome. They want to see lean mass development. They want to see bone. They want to see reduction in visceral fat. And if they're holding that post-exercise catabolic state, they are not putting in the nutrition that is going to cause the anabolic state in a more rapid responsive rate. So again, it's not about, I know there isn't a lot of evidence, and we see that now over the course of the past 5 or 6 years, a lot with Stu's work, that there is more the distribution aspect. But when we start looking at shutting down that catabolic state and reducing the impact on endocrine health, post-exercise nutrition and timing for women becomes really important.
Okay. So, and so... Lauren, do you have a response to that? And again, kind of based upon human more absolute human outcome trials, or is that along the lines of what you'd consider telling people to?
Yeah, I think, describing, anabolic or catabolic states and looking at the post-workout nutrition as, what's going to kind of turn on that cascade. The exercise is the stimulus for growth. So if I'm lifting weights, then I'm sensitizing the muscle, and then bringing in nutrition is going to be kind of the icing on the cake. So that's my stimulus, and then I want to optimize the stimulus with the adequate protein. But the timing of that nutrition isn't really going to make a difference, because that window of post-exercise in order to further stimulate is a pretty long window. And what we see is whether, we're eating immediately post-workout or we're waiting an hour, what's important is overall calories and overall protein. And we've measured the anabolic, catabolic response in terms of protein synthesis and breakdown in both menstrual phases. There's no difference. So I think bringing in the menstrual cycle and that level of overcomplication makes it even more confusing for women who probably don't even know which menstrual cycle phase they're in. So, I think bottom line is the evidence shows the training is the most important stimulus for growth. If you eat right after the gym, or you eat an hour later, or you eat 2 hours later, long-term muscle growth is not going to be affected.
And I'll like to jump in on there too, right? So if we're seeing women, and this is, I'm just giving a case example, right? Because we're talking about real time. We see women who will go to the gym early. They'll do heavy lifting. They are doing their periodized program. They delay their intake. They'll get stronger, but they won't put on lean mass. If they go in and they are doing fed training, they'll put on some lean mass. If they go in fasted, they do their heavy lifting and they eat afterwards, they'll put on lean mass. So what we're looking at here is not the calories. It's not necessarily the timing of the protein. It's the fact that women don't necessarily take every eating opportunity they need to. So when we're talking about post-exercise food and nutrition, I'm pulling from, let's look at what's happening from a low energy state. Because we see that this is what happens when we are delaying food intake post-exercise. We're perceived as being in a low energy state. And if we're looking at what happens with a low energy availability state, we start to see after 4 days, there's a downturn in our thyroid function. So when we're talking to women and saying, hey, we want to optimize health, we want to optimize lean mass development, we want to optimize our bone health, then that post-exercise nutrition becomes really important. Because we know that there's a blunting of appetite and people are like, I'm delay at my food intake. And then we start seeing the outcomes of low energy availability. And if we're talking from practical terms, that's really important. It's really important.
All right, can I jump in?
Hold on, can I ask one thing? No, hold on, come on. Because I just want to make sure, because our audience there's a wide variability of different types of people. So again, we're seeing a lot of people with obesity, diabetes, metabolic dysfunction. There, you're kind of talking about an energy availability.
Lean athletes.
Right. You guys are, so there's a difference between low body fat lean athletes And some of our patients, especially when you start getting into, you mentioned the thyroid, that's kind of a sick euthyroid thing that we see. It's a normal process when people have really low body fat under high levels of stress, high exercise, low intake. It's also part of what, you know, cortisol's up on a chronic basis, that, you know, gets into the whole female athlete triad, the hypothalamic amenorrhea. So I just want to make sure people are clear as to, you know, kind of the different things we're talking
about. Yeah, that's my lane. I'm not in the obesity world. I'm not in the general pop. I'm in my lane. Yeah.
All right. Spencer.
All right. So, doctor, Stucci, what you're saying is, if people, and I don't want to put words in your mouth. So you're saying that if people do, women do fasted training, they will end up actually not eating as much in total. So in general, you're saying they won't get as much protein. They won't get as many calories. And if they, but if they did, yeah, what Dr. Lauren's saying, it wouldn't matter. But you're saying because they go fasted, it blunts their appetite, so they end up eating fewer calories and protein overall anyway. And I don't want to put words in your mouth. So that's what's going through my mind. Is that right?
Yeah, because the group that I'm always in and the literature that I'm always in is all about how are we optimizing our body composition from a bone health, from a muscle health, and how are we eliminating things like low energy availability, right? Because I am not in the general pop. I'm in the literature here of active women, right? So when we're looking at eating opportunities and we're looking at appetite perturbations and we're trying to get people to have a better idea of what it means to be fed, what it means to have appetite control, and we want to reduce the ill effects of low energy availability, we look at that post-exercise nutrition as a very important point to be able to maximize muscle growth, maximize our appetite hormone perturbations. We look at it as an opportunity to be able to have that eating opportunity that is going to increase the amount of calories that they're taking in. So when we're looking at the absolute molecular level of what is happening with protein intake, yeah, the window's great. But if we're telling a woman, look, you know what? It doesn't matter when you eat, then they miss this massive eating opportunity that is going to be a direct benefit to their body and their hormonal cascade.
Okay, Dr. Lauren, what do you have to say?
Yeah, well, I fully agree that low energy availability is a problem. There can be, you know, a host of health issues if you are in a chronic state of low energy availability. But that to me is a very different conversation than to say, oh, you know, because you are a woman, you need 30 grams of protein within a half hour of your training session, else you will be in a state of low energy availability. Those are just two different things. And it's the same thing with the fasted training, right? So you're, yes, low energy availability is a problem, but these nuances and nutrient timing aren't important for preventing a state of low energy availability.
No, but post-exercise, your brain is perceiving you as being in a calorie deficit because you have used the calories and it is perceiving you as being in a low energy state. So if women keep holding that, then we see that it does create the same kind of perturbation, even if they do have optimal calorie intake. If they're booking their calories on either end of the day and they have a big hole in the day of a perception of a low energy, it's still as if they are in a low energy state, even if they have the same amount of calories that they need. So it does become important.
So are there long-term clinical trials where there's this whole, as you described, chronically, yes. However, sufficient calories and protein are being consumed, and then we're seeing menstrual cycle dysfunction, muscle loss, other health issues?
We're seeing a lot of work coming out of Copenhagen that's looking specifically at this. And we see that when they're comparing women who have menstrual cycle dysfunction versus women who have normal menstrual cycle, then those who have menstrual cycle dysfunction tend to fall in, or I shouldn't say tend, do fall into the state of having adequate calorie intake, but there's a misstep of when those calories are placed. For those women who have normal menstrual cycle function, they are eating after exercise and eating at regular intervals throughout the day. So I, again, am happy to share those studies with you.
All right, so let me see if... So if people are doing fasted exercise, especially... lean female athletes, they probably really do need to get in some post-workout protein for sure. I'll buy, you know, I think that kind of goes across the board for everybody. But you're saying There are studies showing like real clinical outcome differences for people with, you know, equivalent, sufficient caloric protein intake throughout the whole day, even in a fed, you know, even if they're in a fed exercise state. Let's say they eat breakfast, they go work out. You're saying they still need, you know, 30 grams of protein, we'll call it, after the workout to prevent that sort of insufficient energy situation, and it's causing what I mentioned as hypothalamic, like amenorrhea, like irregular menstrual cycle things?
Yes. That's the short answer.
Okay.
I'm trying to find the author of the study so I can give you a name.
Yeah, I mean, either way, we will definitely put these citations in the show notes. But while she's looking for that, Lauren, I mean, your perspective on the evidence-based practicality of that, from what you know. I mean, she's looking up the study
I'm concerned that we're sort of doing the same thing, right? We're looking at these short-term windows or short-term measures and then saying, okay, well, if in this single day study, or if theoretically this hormonal cascade is happening, or if we're measuring this single pathway, and then extrapolating upon that to say we are going to experience these outcomes long term that are somehow deleterious. And that's missing a huge step. It's one thing to speculate and hypothesize based on mechanisms or pathways or rodent data. It's another to translate that to, hey, if you are a woman, you should never train fasted and you must eat protein within 30 minutes of your workout.
Or is it? We need to make sure we see the outcome data that is hypothesized.
Right. We want to actually measure that long-term outcome of interest. 100%. Yeah.
Because that would be a big deal that I have not seen, you know, endocrinology training and data that, you know, all things being equal, calories, protein, body fat, training, especially, and let's just say in a fed state, so not a fasted, you know, not an overnight fast or something, that not getting, you know, protein within that anabolic window that we used to call it, would lead to sort of the hypothalamic pituitary gonadal axis dysfunction. So that, I mean, because that's a big deal if that's the case.
Yeah. So Monica Torsvit, she is the lead author on a lot of these studies that are looking at within day energy deficit and metabolic perturbations. So, and it's not just a one-off study. They follow them for quite a few months. And they have also done it in men. So the outcomes for metabolic perturbation in men versus women, we see some decrease in testosterone, decrease in maximal oxygen uptake. And for women, we see a reduction in thyroid. We see a reduction in menstrual cycle status.
And again, so, that's not chronic energy, you know, sub-optimization. That's just purely talking about protein intake.
No, this is about total calories and the way that it's distributed throughout the day. So if we're looking at bookending the day with food and you're getting optimal macronutrient, optimal calorie intake, you're still going to end up with a perturbation because we're seeing this big hole of no food. When we're looking at what they're talking about within day energy deficiency and timing, and then if you overlay that on the public health data coming from chronobiology, they mimic each other with regards to how we are seeing metabolic perturbation with calorie intake and where we are placing those calories.
And what specific perturbation? So I'm seeing like cortisol to testosterone ratio, or testosterone to cortisol ratios, which again is more
But that's acutely, and that doesn't matter in the
we just
clinically.
I guess that, yeah.
Right. I mean, we can say, testosterone increased post-exercise, but that doesn't mean that we're going to see more growth long term. And there's so many examples of this where we measure something and then get really bogged down in, oh, you know, well, this increased, and therefore, are we going to see a development of a pathology, or are we going to see a down regulation that leads to fat loss? Or leads to muscle growth or muscle loss, because those are the outcomes that people are actually interested in and hear when you say you shouldn't do this or you must do this.
I don't say shouldn't or must. I don't say shouldn't or must. This is the misconception, the same as you guys shouting out that I study rats. I don't study rats. I don't cite rodent studies. And I don't say you should or shouldn't. I'm giving evidence. I'm saying this is what's optimal, and you make your decisions. I don't have hard and fast rules. So
you
if
say
I'm looking
specifically, fasted training doesn't work for women. A calorie deficit doesn't work for women. How is that not a blanket statement?
Because I'm not saying you should or shouldn't. I'm saying this is what the evidence, and we're saying, look, fasted training doesn't work well for women when we're looking at the outcomes that people are doing for fasted training. We see more perturbation in our endocrine system than what's healthy. And if I'm looking right here at this study over here that is looking at within calorie deficit, says this group of well-trained women, 65% has suppressed RMR, and despite similar energy availability and 24-hour energy balance compared with subjects with normal RMR, they spent more time in severe energy deficit within the day. Had a larger single-hour energy deficit, which was associated with higher cortisol levels.
In one
That's
day,
interesting,
though.
But again, we would want to see how that plays out in the longer term, and then see, okay, well, let's measure this in the day in that 24-hour period. This is interesting. It's hypothesis generating. It's not ready to be translated in such a practical blanket way, in my opinion.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's all fair. I mean, and again, kind of from practicality perspectives, again, with, you know, the cortisol stuff. So high intensity exercise, all exercise increases cortisol. That's a normal physiologic response. We want that to happen with cortisol. Cortisol in and of itself is not a bad thing unless you have medication-induced, pituitary or adrenal-induced excess cortisol. And those are huge problems that I deal with. So, you know, normal cortisol response in the morning, normal cortisol response to exercise. We would prefer to not have chronic stressors and chronic anorexia causing excess cortisol, but that's more about, but that's still physiologic. So, all right, so we're going to move on. We'll put those things in the show notes and, you know, let people discuss that. I think that's going to be interesting data to discuss in the future if getting protein right after exercise with being the only variable, I think is what you're saying, is important for hypothalamic pituitary gonadalaxis.
We should get this Dr. Monica on. We'll talk to her. Interesting. All right, go to the calorie.
Is that who should just talk about from Copenhagen?
Short height.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Okay, so next one. Now this is a fun one. So there was Stacy. Do women over 30? Obviously, this number is coming from something, maybe from what you said. Do women over 30 need high load but low reps and shorter intercept rest periods for muscle and strength gains compared to obviously the opposite of lower load, high reps, longer intercept rest periods? And compared to men for muscle growth and strength gains? That was one question.
It's not 30. It's perimenopause. So we see that perimenopause.
So we'll call it in your 40s and 50s then.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Because one of the very first things that happens with perimenopause and the change in our ratios of estrogen and progesterone is a dysfunction in myosin. So we see a change in the phosphorylation of myosin. So we have less of a strong muscle contraction. One of the first things that we see when you start doing heavier or higher loads and lower volume is a change in your myosin phosphorylation, because it is a central nervous system response, right? So when we're looking at strength development, when you start getting into perimenopause, we see this precipitous loss in strength and power. And then about a year or so later, you start losing lean mass. So when we talk about lifting heavy, it's about really mitigating that loss in strength and power that's functional. When we're looking at, okay, let's get strong and stay strong so we keep our proprioception, we keep our power. And along the way, we're also building lean mass.
So when we're looking at a regular periodized program, of course, we're not going to have everyone go do 5x5s all the time because that's just not appropriate. It's like I'll use those examples because that's trying to get people to understand the power base end of muscle function. So when we're looking at how are we changing it up, a lot of people in my age group who have grown up with exercise and strength training really have the idea of the 90s where you have pink dumbbells and really high reps. And we see that that doesn't counter this change in our myosin phosphorylation. You have to do the heavy loads. So when we're trying to get people to really focus on maintaining strength and lean mass, we want them to periodize in that power-based training, and trying to get women to understand that and to do that has been really interesting, and we see the change in that. For the outcomes, we see in the literature, and it's coming out more and more, that the power end of the strength spectrum is really beneficial from 40 all the way up to 70 or 80. And you will put on a cumulative amount of lean mass as well, but it's the strength component that's really important for maintaining life.
Can you give us some specific numbers? Because I guess in my mind, I think, you know, heavy load, low repetition is kind of like, you know, like 3 to 6 repetitions compared to, say, you know, 8 to 12 to 15 repetitions of, you know, lighter to moderate weight.
Close to failure, by the way.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, and in the grand scheme of things, it seems like all the studies are now showing that kind of all those, you know, weight and rep ranges are all kind of very similar for muscle hypertrophy. Obviously, right. there are you know, subtle differences for, you know, power lifting compared to endurance training for athletes. And then, of course, in the metabolic health world, I'd argue that we just need more volume kind of in general. But so can you give me some numbers, and then we'll let Lauren kind of, you know, potentially counter to anything.
Yeah. And there is, and I will say, yes, there is literature coming out showing that there really is no difference in the lean mass gain, like that muscle hypertrophy. And that's not what I'm worried about. I'm worried about the strength component. So if we're looking at 3 to 6 at 80% one rep max, that's what we're doing. And it's all relative. And it's not that we're going to throw someone in right away. We have to phase them in just like anybody else, right? We don't want injury. We don't want people to hate it.
You don't want Grandma doing 300-pound back squats yet right off the bat? Yeah. All right, fair enough.
We want everyone to be like trained like Joan Rodaway. No, it's phasing people in and learning how to move. What is their mobility? All the things that you do in a proper periodized overload program. But instead of phasing people into, you know, 3 sets or 4 sets of 10 to 15, which is our hypertrophy end, we really need women to start, as they start getting into perimenopause and seeing these changes and losing that strength and power, we want them to do the heavier loads, and then you can periodize into more hypertrophy type stuff.
Okay, Dr. Lauren.
Lauren?
Well, our sort of understanding of this, you know, strength endurance continuum has really evolved over time. So there was a point in time where, you know, all the personal trainers certifications taught that, you know, you need to do these high load, low reps for strength and more moderate reps for hypertrophy, and then anything above 12 and it's just muscular endurance and it's not actually, you know, useful for either of those things. But our understanding has evolved to the point that we realize as long as you're training close enough to failure, all of those rep ranges and loads can induce muscle growth. When we think about strength, certainly if you're training for maximal strength, as in one rep max, then you need to be training in a sport-specific manner. So we need to use those high loads and low reps because our outcome of interest is a one rep max. But even if you're training in the 8 to 10 rep range, you're still getting stronger if you increase load over time. So for the majority of people, from a kind of aging and a muscle health perspective, I think the message should be make it challenging and make it progressive.
Dr. Stacy,
any response to that? Because all sounds pretty reasonable to me.
It all sounds, yeah, pretty reasonable and the same. It's just the same. It's like... Okay.
What was the
from a sociocultural perspective, right? So I'm 52, right? And so I grew up with the Kate Moss era and the pink dumbbells. And so if we were trying to get women to get in the gym and challenge themselves, we have to give them numbers. If we say go in for 8 to 10, they're not going to challenge themselves. And I understand where Lauren is coming from, and I've seen the literature, but I'm also seeing a lot of literature coming in and showing that when you're doing the 3 to 6 and you're really challenging central nervous system, you're gaining a significant amount of strength and power and lean mass, which goes forward to proprioception, preventing falls. When we're seeing this being implemented in older individuals, and we're also seeing that it is building that total strength that women are losing in perimenopause. But yes, it is a total periodized program. It's not like we're going to put someone on a power-based program year in, year out, and there's no change. Because we want them to have this strength, and we also want them to put on some lean mass.
Yeah. Hopefully nobody listening to this podcast disagrees that we need everyone to get into the gym or at home, do some strength training, progressively load it up. And yes, we need our perimenopausal females to do weight-bearing exercise, strength training, progressively overload, be stronger, prevent falls. That's why I tell my patients, no matter what medicine we talk about for their osteoporosis, if we can find a way to make sure they don't fall over the next 40 years, they're probably not going to break a hip. So that's really good. So then, do you get into some of this weighted vest stuff, right?
I don't.
No, you don't talk about that. Okay, so we'll save that for another podcast. I thought maybe that was one of the things we had to talk about.
All right, that's the last part. We have time for one more claim that we want to make sure we're
all right.
Is it the calorie deficit one?
Well, I think we kind of already got into that, into the calorie deficit stuff. But what about the training around menstrual cycle? The benefit.
No, that's a good one.
Are there any truth? Nuances to recommending differences in training and nutrition around a female's menstrual cycle that we haven't been able
Let's
to.
Let Dr. I want to see Dr. Lauren say it first. Then I want Dr.
The right. Sounds good.
Oh, I was all geared up, man.
Three a curveball. All right.
Yeah, we're throwing a curveball.
This was like things have changed in the past 5 years.
Okay. Let's just hear what Dr. Lauren says. Right. This is her research right here. Like a lot of specifically. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a good example of something that it is mechanistically interesting that doesn't really seem to be panning out in a practical way. So when we look at the effect of estrogen deficiency in rodents through removing the ovaries, and then we see, oh, maybe there's an effect on muscle. That's interesting. But then the question is, obviously, that doesn't translate to short-term fluctuations around the menstrual cycle. So, you know, the work that I did was to really evaluate that question. Is the high estrogen follicular phase, quote unquote, anabolic for muscle? And is the high progesterone luteal phase, quote unquote, catabolic for muscle? And in a very tightly controlled within subject design, there were no differences in protein synthesis or breakdown. More importantly, the experience of the menstrual cycle for the participants was so different in terms of the timing and magnitude of the hormone fluctuations. So prescribing any sort of cookie cutter program that doesn't account for those differences is really, really short-sighted. And I think consistency is key when it comes to adaptations to exercise. So anything that discourages consistency is problematic.
Yeah. I mean, if you were to ask me this question 5 years ago, I would have said, well, from the molecular basis and what we're seeing in early literature, especially from the 90s, that yes, phase-based training makes sense. But as we start really digging into it and looking at proper methodology, and we also know that a lot of women aren't ovulating, and every woman's experience of their menstrual cycle is different, it has to be an individualized thing, right? So you know there are some days where you feel great and some days you don't feel great. Well, change your training up so that you're doing harder stress on the days you feel great and then maybe some recovery on the days that you don't. I think I'll take ownership of pushing out, you know, like phase-based training in the early days. And I've retracted that saying, hey, the science doesn't support that anymore. And that's the beauty of science. And the more evidence you get, the more that you can like put out there and say, hey, wait, you know what? There's so many nuances here. We know that some women are heavily affected by it. And so they need to track and understand how they're affected. We also see some women are completely unfazed. I was getting very frustrated early days where people were like, you have to take completely 2 weeks off. It's like, no, it's like, you know, from a molecular structure, maybe you want to bring down the intensity, but not take time off. So totally with Lauren, you can't have a cookie cutter. It just doesn't work because there's so many women now who don't ovulate and they don't know it. They'll still have a bleed, but that's an anovulatory bleed. So if they're trying to phase-based train and they think they're bleeding, they're actually, as Lauren's saying, they're missing consistency. They're missing the mark.
Yeah.
I appreciate
consistency the consistency sort of over complexity.
If I may, I want to say I appreciate you updating your perspective on that. But just a key that I wanted to touch on is you said I was really relying heavily on kind of molecular work, and maybe now we have more human subject data that's actually measuring those outcomes that we're interested in, or improving methodology, et cetera. So I'm wondering, are there any claims or a bit that you have now that you think, you know, I am relying pretty heavily on molecular work, but I look forward to more data that will inform us, that maybe will help me maintain that opinion or evolve it as required?
From a molecular standpoint, only the menstrual cycle stuff. And I'm still really interested in some of the stuff that's coming out because we have to look right now. Well, I'll also take it out as I'm also very interested in how the menopause research is playing out, not from a molecular standpoint, but from a population standpoint. Because unfortunately, most of the women's health research that's being conducted across all lifespan is on people like me and Lauren. We're white, upper class. We have the availability of going in and being participants in studies. We have access to healthcare, but that is a very small in total global space. So I'm working with friends who are sociologists, and they're like, well, what about what happens in menstrual cycle in Pacifica populations or African-American populations or African women who are playing soccer? So those are all different experiences. And the same with menopause. Like, every culture has a different conversation about menopause. So those are the interesting conversations that are coming out in the literature that can actually play out of how we are approaching and applying practical information.
That's a great way to conclude that, because we definitely need to study all these different things across all different people, from young athletes with low body fat to those who are struggling with weight, metabolic disease, perimenopausal, postmenopausal, elderly people, and in all different ethnicities. And that is where we struggle for sure. We have a lot of data in our obesity realm. A lot of patients in those studies are females, so we have a lot of sort of perimenopausal data on them. And then ironically, a lot of the type 2 diabetes with some of those same medicines are, you know, predominantly, you know, white men, et cetera. So that's I think that's a great point. Any other specific questions, Spencer, you got?
Like, no, I was just going to say, so we have like 5 minutes left. And so from my observation, Dr. Lauren is similar to us, where we're like, we're very RCT outcome based.
But also pragmatic, you know, clinically, yeah. Clinically relevant based. What are the actual hard outcomes show? Because in medicine, we have a lot of meds that were like, oh, they were studied, they look right mechanistically, yeah. And then it turns out to kill
or
something. Yeah. No.
And this is the frustrating thing, because I have a friend who's a vet, and she's like, animals are dosed way better and have better outcomes on meds than humans do. I'm like, yeah, that's true, because my husband and I get sent home with the same prescription after surgery for a painkiller. It's like, what, why? Because we're missing the mark. And the other thing that worries me in healthcare is AI-driven outcomes, right? We're having AI that is reading the data that's already there, that's already heavily biased, and it ignores the nuances, and the nuances happen to be women's health. So, I mean, it's an interesting landscape for sure.
So yeah, I'd like to close it out. And then what I notice is, like, Dr. Sims cares about the practical and does look at some of the RCT, but does get more into the mechanistic stuff that has some smaller outcomes that may lead to longer term. Am I off base there? It just seems like Dr. Lauren's like RCT or GTFO. That's a joke.
I don't know that she's like, man,
that's
right.
No, but it's a joke. Because I get annoyed online when some people come up with some mechanism. I'm like, yeah, but like in the end, does it really matter? For example, like the fasted versus fed, and some of that stuff. So it's just kind of an interesting difference. But practically, sounds like you guys are similar. I don't know.
Yeah.
Let the
practically,
listener,
we all want people to move. We want people to eat well. We want people to sleep well. It's and we want people to wear their bodies.
Because yeah. yeah. some are
in our world, we want some of the basics.
When we see some people make claims, then some patients get confused. Like, wait, do I have to just do this? And it's like, well, and then we have to have this discussion. I think that's where a lot of the I don't want to say animosity, but sometimes it's animosity. Like, oh, why'd they say that?
I think what my point really is, I'm certainly interested in mechanism. That's why I became a scientist. I think the why behind the what is fascascinating, and the more we learn, the better. Nerds. But if we're going to communicate science in a practical way and tell people how to eat and how to train, then we need to be careful that we're not jumping the gun and that we are relying on the RCTs. So I just think there's a difference between scientifically interesting and practically actionable.
Okay.
Yeah. Fair enough.
That's reasonable.
But overall, right. this was really fun. Thank you, Stacy and Lauren.
Being a good sport.
I think people will really, really appreciate this conversation. Having an open conversation about this stuff, having some practical points that come out of it, but also some interesting scientific things that we can cite. So yeah, please send us those, and we'll put them in the show notes. And we'll try to organize it in some sort of coherent manner, Spencer.
Yeah.
My topic.
I'm going to be stuck doing that, I'm sure, but whatever.
No, I'm pretty sure my video guy who's standing here is going to do it. So I'm just staring right here. So if anybody has a friend or family or anybody that is interested in women's fitness, health, and training, make sure you share this with them. Make sure you subscribe. You can check out Dr. Stacy Sims. She's all over the internet. Dr. Lauren, who we've had on multiple times, you can check out her Instagram as well. We'll put those links in the show notes. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Thank you.
Outro.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll